There is protein lattes from Starbucks, protein popcorn from Khloe Kardashian. There's even protein water, protein Pop-Tarts. You name it, they've put protein in it. But really, how much is too much? And what does the latest science say about all this protein? I'm Lee Rayburn, and our next guest is one of the authors of a recent study published in peer-reviewed that looked to answer this question. And if you have a question about protein, our intake of it, how much is too much, and its impact on our health, you are welcome to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. Dudley Lamming is a professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism with the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dudley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
So set this up for us a little bit. Your study actually looked at hundreds of other studies to analyze the protein's effect on our health. How did you go about it?
This was actually a review, by some scientists written for other scientists. So we were reviewing both human studies as well as a lot of studies that's been conducted in animals and even in fruit flies over the last 10 to 20 years about dietary protein levels and health.
So when it comes to protein, it seems like this is a recent marketing push. Was there a point where we were generally not getting enough protein? Where did this protein push come from, if you could speculate, and why is it everywhere all of a sudden?
Well, protein has a lot of really great qualities. So, one of the things that is really attracted people to protein for at least two decades, maybe probably even longer, is the fact that protein promotes satiety. That is, it helps us feel full. Mm. And so, studies since the time of World War II has sort of suggested that different types of fat might be bad in the diet and that we should cut down on particular types of fats like trans fats. And, more recently, people have thought that we're eating too many sugars in our diet, particularly particular types of sugars, and that we need to cut down those as well. And so to balance that, people have said, oh, we should eat more protein because that helps us feel full. And that's definitely true. Protein does promote satiety. And many people are familiar with the fact that protein helps us build muscle, particularly when we're doing certain types of exercise. And many athletes and people who are trying to build muscles take extra protein supplements. Many people who are over the age of 65 are also advised by their doctors to increase the amount of protein they have because they're fighting something called sarcopenia, which is age-related muscle loss that can increase frailty. So protein has a lot of beneficial qualities.
But I would imagine then that you are looking at what the sweet spot would be in general for people and their protein intake. And it also sounds like that might vary on age and current health.
Yeah, so this is something that I started looking into around 2014 because a couple studies started coming out. One was analyzing data from NHANES, which is a very long-running NIH study of the human population. For many different factors. And something that was surprising to me that came out of that study was the fact that they found that people who are eating more protein were actually at higher risk of age-related diseases like cancer and diabetes, and actually had a higher risk of mortality as well. And so then we started looking into this, and it turns out that this has been a signal that's been found in many different studies from around the globe, that people who tend to eat more protein are at higher risk of cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other age-related disorders, even though we think of protein as something that's good for us and should be promoting health. So we're really interested in trying to dive into, what's behind that.
So what did you find in terms of what is behind this? Because on one hand, you make a good case for the value of protein. On the other hand, the science shows that there could be some age-related illnesses that could be exacerbated due to protein intake.
Yeah. So, to sort of cut a longer story short, I think protein is beneficial and is particularly seems to be beneficial in people who are exercising. And this is something that we've been able to explore with animal models, where we see that mice eating a higher protein diet essentially are more metabolically challenged. So they grow more fat mass, they seem to be becoming less able to regulate their blood sugar. but these effects are ablated by exercise. And so, you know, when we think about how much protein we should be eating, one of the things that really seems to be critical of that is to take into account this activity. Are we using that protein in our diet to build healthy skeletal muscle or not? And when we look at the general population, the majority of people, you know, in America and many other developed countries are overweight or obese, probably not moving enough. And, you know, that seems to be a case where maybe in that general population, more dietary protein might be harmful and metabolically challenging, even though it can, when it's combined with exercise, it can lead to better health outcomes.
So, yeah, and one of the things that we regularly hear from folks who are interested in better health is regular exercise and making sure that you keep that body moving. And I think that's pretty much across the board. And it also sounds like that seems to be part of the outcome of the conclusion of your study here, Dudley, that in order to have a healthy amount of protein, you have to have a healthy lifestyle that includes some element of exercise.
Well, I think it's very clear that, you know, many different studies have shown that, you know, a certain amount of activity, even a certain amount of walking can be very beneficial for health and for aging, in particular for, you know, not becoming frail as we get older. So I think that's beyond a shadow of a doubt. Some of the other things that we were sort of, you know, investigating in this review was looking at the role of the building blocks of protein, which are called amino acids. Mm-hmm. And so there are 20 of these amino acids in the diet. 9 of them are essential for humans as well as for mice, where we conduct a lot of these studies. The amino acids that we've really tended to focus on are the branch chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, and valine. And these are familiar to a lot of people in the context of health supplements, because a lot of protein supplements that people take, if they're athletes or bodybuilders, really focus on these BCAAs. They're thought to be particularly important for building strong muscles. And what we found there was that a lot of the metabolic effects of protein that seem to be negative are mediated by these branched-chain amino acids. And so if we reduced dietary levels of just these branched-chain amino acids, we were able to extend the lifespan of mice as well as improve their health span, so keep them from growing as frail as they got older.
So these BCAAs, these branched-chain amino acids, you say they're most likely to be found or most commonly found in things like protein supplements, and this seems to be one of those proteins, am I getting this right, Dudley, that would have a negative impact on aging and age-related illnesses?
Well, so branched amino acids are found in all foods. Okay. So all the amino acids are centrally represented in some amount in all foods. Branched amino acids are generally thought to be high in lots of different types of meat, particularly red meat. Oh. But they are essential for life. So you definitely need some of them. Very bad things happen if you don't have enough of any of the essential amino acids. You know, it does seem that in the context of can we restrict them in the diet, keeping them at a sufficient level rather than a level of excess. And in our mouse studies, we found that by reducing the levels by about 60% in our studies, we find that that leads to mice that live longer. So male mice tend to live about 30% longer. Females don't benefit as much, as well as being leaner, better able to control their blood sugar, remaining fitter as they grow older, so not getting as frail. And in Alzheimer's settings, we actually see that we slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease in mouse models of this disease.
Oh, wow, Dudley. So this also affects the one of these something dementia that we've been talking about potentially, at least in these mice studies. But a 60% reduction in these branched chain amino acids, that's a drastic reduction, isn't it? So what's the practical, what does it look like practically if I were to reduce 60% of these branched chain amino acids?
Yeah, this is not something we'd necessarily recommend people to try at home. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it would be very difficult to design a diet that led to that level of restriction. There's been about 5 or 6 human studies of protein restriction, which has essentially restricted protein by about 50% in humans. And so, as you might imagine, those involve switching to from sort of a conventional American diet to a diet that contains a lot more components, a lot more oils and Mediterranean type foods. But, you know, trying to cut out, you know, as much meat as possible, maybe include some fish or something like that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we're not necessarily advising people to try and reduce the amount of protein in their diet. I do think that, you know, as you sort of alluded to at the beginning, you know, there's a lot of foods now that are protein supplemented. And so, you know, about the idea of people taking more protein without increasing their exercise, that could definitely be something that's approached with more caution.
Dudley Lamming, our guest, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism within the Department of Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking a look at one of the authors of a study that we're looking at now that studied the impact of protein on health. It was a review of more than 350 studies that was published at the end of last month. You can join with your questions or your stories about protein at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. As Stephen Wanaki couldn't stay with us, he said he understands that older people lose the ability to metabolize protein and thus need to consume more. If that's the case, how much protein should you consume as you age, Dudley?
So there's a couple reasons that people are who are older tend to be advised to eat more protein. So one is that, you know, many people who are older tend to have less of an appetite. And so in terms of an absolute amount that they're eating, that goes down. And so increasing the percentage of that food that's protein just to meet their sort of essential requirements is important. It's also generally believed that a lot of people who are on a fixed income as they grow older spend more of their money on carbohydrates because carbohydrate calories are cheaper than protein calories. So, you know, essentially that meat can be expensive. So a lot of elderly people are thought to be protein insufficient and are eating too little protein to maintain their current muscle mass. And so that's definitely a very potential risk. That's something that, you know, needs to be approached on sort of a case-by-case basis, you know, with someone's doctor.
Joanne emailed to say it's ironic that the essential amino acid methionine is added to poultry and animal feed. Now they say too much is being added, according to Joanne. Could that lead to higher mortality of people who eat chicken?
So methionine is one of the essential amino acids, and it has a variety of unique roles in metabolism. And studies starting around the 1990s showed that restricting methionine could extend lifespan in rats. That's been shown in mice as well. And methionine levels are low in some particularly long-lived groups of individuals. Doing that in the diet tends to not work very well. For restricting that in the diet tends to not work very well. For a variety of reasons, but definitely, you know, people are using that as a tool to understand how amino acids and metabolism in general are regulating healthy aging. So, you know, methionine, again, you know, probably the specific level about any one of those amino acids could be, you know, potentially problematic. But I wouldn't want to say that, you know, there's a particular problem with, you know, methionine in chicken as opposed to anywhere else.
All right. Thank you for the email, Joanne. And when we're talking about protein supplements, the way it's being shoved into lattes and popcorn and Pop-Tarts and delivery pizzas, Dudley, is that a different kind of protein? And does that have a different effect than like natural foods like meats and dairy? And does that have a different effect or impact on our health?
It's potentially it could. We have not done too much work into the sources of protein as a regulator of health, but many other groups generally think that, you know, protein from meats are, you know, worse for your health than protein for plants, and there's definitely evidence to suggest that. But, you know, when we were talking about these natural sources, it's confounded by a lot of other factors. For instance, all the different metabolites and things like fiber that you were talking about earlier, right? Plant material obviously has a lot more fiber associated with it, which could be beneficial. So we think, generally speaking, that's about the amount of protein rather than the source.
Okay.
But source could potentially play a role, particularly because of things like fiber and other metabolites that are associated with it.
So what are some high protein plants that I could look for, Dudley?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, people usually ask me what are foods that are low in branched chain amino acids. And that one, I can tell you, people in general think that turkey is relatively low, as well as emu, which interestingly.
I'm sorry. Did you say emu?
I did. And interestingly, there are some emu farms in the Midwest. Hopefully I'll be able to visit one someday. I understand there is a guy who sells emu sometimes at the Capital Farmers Market here in Madison every Saturday.
And that might be a beneficial meat to try if we wanted to lower our branched chain amino acids?
Potentially, but I think we'd probably have to farm a lot more emu if we were going to do that.
Julie from Green Bay called to say that she's 61 years old, who has run 4 to 6 miles a day for the past 25 years, and she was wondering how much protein should she be consuming?
I don't want to give a specific number for a variety of reasons, but certainly seems like, you know, she's very physically active and is getting older, so probably would benefit from more protein than someone who was sedentary.
That sounds about right. And to me here, it seems like the crux of the argument has to do with your lifestyle, that the decision about how much protein to get is kind of dependent on how active you are, Dudley. Is that a general takeaway I can use from your work?
There's a variety of other factors that probably are important too. So we found that, for instance, men and women, or at least male and female mice, tend to respond differently to protein. And this could be dependent on estrogen levels as well. We think that sex could definitely play a role in the response to dietary protein, and that's something we're interested in. And then genetics seem to play a role as well. And so, you know, I think a more comprehensive assessment would be that, you know, the amount of protein that everyone would optimally get probably needs to be personalized based on activity for sure, but some of these other factors as well.
I saw that you were included in a story a few years ago in WPR News about research you did into calorie intake and fasting and how that impacted age-related illness and the potential for longevity in mice.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting story. So it's been well established that calorie restriction extends lifespan in organisms from yeast all the way up to non-human primates. And calorie restriction studies have been done in humans as well and shown beneficial health outcomes. One of the things that one of my students noticed a number of years ago is that calorie restricted animals are fed once a day. And so they tend to binge eat and consume their food because they're hungry. And then basically they eat all of their food in about 3 hours and they spend the rest of the day without any food. And, you know, time-restricted feeding had become very popular probably about 10 years ago as potentially a lifestyle that would enable people to cut calories with more easily and maybe have other beneficial health outcomes as well. And so what we found in that study was that fasting period is super important. When we fed animals using other dietary regimens that sort of stretched out the period where they ate food, we could reduce calories, but if they didn't have that fasting period, they didn't experience the benefits of the diet. And so they didn't have improvements in their ability to regulate blood sugar, they didn't necessarily live longer, they didn't have cognitive improvements as well. And so that fasting period was super important. And then conversely, we were able to actually reproduce a lot of the benefits by not cutting calories, but just compressing food intake into a short period each day. This sort of time-restricted feeding study has been done by a number of groups now in humans. And they found that generally it is true that you do get health benefits in humans if you compress the food intake interval to about 6 hours a day. That seems to be primarily driven by a decrease in calories that you consume. So basically, you can't overeat as readily if you have to eat all of your food in 6 hours.
Dudley Lamming, how has your research affected you personally? I mean, do you avoid protein-infused products when you go to the grocery? Are you a plant-based diet when you can do it? Are you eating emu burgers?
I have been wanting to get some emu burgers because I'm very curious about how they taste, but haven't managed to do it. You know, I think this is a really interesting question, right? Because a lot of researchers who are studying diet, are asked about. And some people I've met definitely really adapt their diet, to the things that they're studying. I personally don't. I think like most Americans, I find it very difficult to adhere to sort of restricted diets with so many wonderful, delicious food options that are available, particularly in Wisconsin, right? So, so that is definitely, an issue. In the long term, right, I think that it's probably not realistic to expect people to, have to map their diet around like limiting protein or limiting specific amino acids. The long-term ideal would be that, we use this as tools to find new mechanisms that maybe we can inform our, what type of foods that go into the diets in general, like do we supplement protein into all these different types of foods or not? And then more specifically, can we find, new medications or new ways of getting people some of the benefits of these diets without having to make dramatic lifestyle changes.
Let's go to Sheena in Green Bay next. Sheena, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You mentioned a couple minutes ago about there might need to be some tinkering with the protein level based on male-female. I'm a trans female, and I'm wondering how I should approach that.
That's an interesting question and not something we've explored directly. But we see that generally speaking, male mice tend to benefit more from protein restriction than female mice, at least metabolically and in terms of their effects on lifespan. And in females, we've done some experiments that have sort of pointed to estrogen signaling as key in that. And so if we block estrogen signaling in the females, then they respond more like the males.
Dudley, we talked about your past work. We're talking about your current work. What's your future work look like? What sort of hypothesis are you wrangling next?
Yeah, so we're really trying to dive in now, both on terms of molecular mechanisms and figuring out what's mediating these specific things, specific effects of proteins and amino acids so that we can work on translating that to humans. And then really sort of trying to piece apart this question about exercise and diet. What is the best combination of diet and exercise in terms of healthy aging? And we're working on that in preclinical models and then hopefully moving to human studies. Another really important question that we don't know the answer to yet is, is resistance exercise and aerobic exercise the same in terms of their effects? Or, would the best outcome be, a combination? And then how this interacts with age is also super important because maybe someone who is in their early life, maybe they would get the best health outcomes long term with a different diet than someone late in life. And maybe diets need to switch over time.
Sure. With about a minute left, Dudley, Kathy emailed to ask if there's a blood test to determine your protein level or how do you know if you are deficient?
Yeah, so your doctor can help you figure out whether or not you're protein deficient, sort of looking at different metabolites in your blood to suggest whether that's an issue. There are some very complicated tests that can be done in a laboratory setting, but are not available in the clinical setting yet to look exactly at what's happening to protein. Maybe that's something that, if there's sufficient demand, might expand over time.
And the bigger picture here seems to be, we go back to the central theme that the individualization, yet you are a unique person and that, what is right for your body is largely dependent on how your body responds to these things. But there are some things we know, the fruits and the vegetables and the exercise seem to be standard for everybody, Dudley.
Definitely seems to be. And yes, you're a very special person, Lee.
That's all I wanted to hear. Dudley Lamming, professor in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And I hope you'll join us again with your latest research. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you for being a part of the show. Thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News.